Hey everyone, this is Adam Ellenboss from Nightlight Astrology. Today we are going to take a look at Jupiter's upcoming entrance into the sign of Gemini from the archetypal perspective. So we're going to start turning that archetypal jewel and we're going to start looking at things like Jupiter in Mercury's sign and what that means. We're going to start looking at the seasonal symbolism of Gemini from the standpoint of the solar year and what the sign of Gemini means archetypally. We're going to try to put it all together and give you some things to watch for over the course of the entire next year that Jupiter spends its time in Gemini. So that is our agenda for today. You might be thinking, where is the new moon forecast? Today is the new moon in Taurus, but we did that yesterday. So we took a look at the new moon to start the week. If you missed it, go back to yesterday's video and check it out if you're looking for new moon content. We're going to move ahead today, having kind of covered the new moon energy, and move right into previewing Jupiter and Gemini. So that's the agenda for today. Before we get into it, don't forget to like and subscribe. It really does help the channel to grow when you like, subscribe, and share your comments. It really helps create community around the channel as well. So you can find a transcript of today's talk or any of my daily talks on my website, nightlightastrology.com. I want to take you over there right now and feature our promotions before getting into content for the day. So if you go over to the live talks page on nightlightastrology.com, the events, go to events, go to live talks. You'll see coming up on May 16th, I'm giving a talk on Neptune's entrance into Aries. This will be a really good one for all of us to start thinking about Neptune's transition into Aries, which happens next year. But Neptune will be stationing and turning retrograde at that last degree of Pisces coming up here. So it's a good time to start thinking about what it might look like with Neptune in Aries for a very long period of time coming up. In June, I'll be giving a talk on the 12th house. In July, Uranus's entrance into Gemini, which also happens next year. These talks, if you register and you can't attend live, we give you the webinar link when you register. But if you can't attend live, we also send you the recording link so that you can watch it on your own time. And you can check out all of our previous live talks, masterclasses, and other really cool content, including access to my book, Chapter by Chapters, before it's published on the shop page as well. So you can see everything we have there, which is also includes the archives of previous talks. The other thing we're promoting is our first-year course, Ancient Astrology for the Modern Mystic, first-year course in Hellenistic Astrology. We have a year one, year two, and year three program for people interested in developing a professional natal practice, or many people come to our programs just for the sake of developing their hobby and their spiritual interest. Studying astrology, like any spiritual topic, is healing and transformative. It is a very good time to begin studying as Jupiter in Gemini will be trining Pluto in Aquarius at the outset of this new program. It's a very auspicious set of planetary configurations, including the recent Jupiter-Uranus dynamic under which to begin an astrological study course. Anyway, at the bottom, you'll find the early bird payment lasts until May 15th. That is the same for year two and horary. So if you're interested in those programs, I'm going to be doing a little promotion for the horary class next week. find the early bird payment, early bird tuition plan, spread it out across 12 months. Those sales are available until May 15th. Then we have need-based tuition assistance, and that's available for people who might be on a fixed income or limited income for whatever reason. If you are someone who really wants to take the program, study astrology, but you need a little flexibility in your budget, please do take advantage of that. When you apply, you tell us what you can afford within a sliding scale, and we set you up with a matching payment plan. So those programs start in June. Really excited to have you take part in them. And if you want to learn more about it, again, after today's content is over, there is a video where I go into greater depth explaining the programs and what they include and how they work. All right, on that note, let us turn our attention now to Jupiter's entrance into the sign of Gemini. Here you can see that we're moving closer to Jupiter's entrance into Gemini. The sun will cross Jupiter and Jupiter will be reborn and start rising as the morning star as it is also culminating in Taurus. It's an interesting consideration. We'll be looking at that more. So here we go, though. This is the magical time, which is May 25th. May 25th in the evening, Jupiter will transition into Gemini. Now, what I want to show you is if we leap forward an entire year to May 25th of 2025, you'll see that Jupiter will then be culminating at the final degree of Gemini. So that by June 8th into the 9th, we're going to take this forward just a little bit here. on, yeah, it's technically it's on June 9th, then Jupiter will enter Cancer. So it's about a year that Jupiter spends per sign. It takes roughly 12 years to go through the entire zodiac. That means from late May until of this year, 2024, until early June of 2025, Jupiter will be in the sign of Gemini. Now, we looked at the horoscopes for May in terms of Jupiter's entrance into Gemini. So you could go back to those if you want some reminders of what topics might be active in your specific birth chart. The whole sign house version of your birth chart, of course, is found by listening to your rising sign. So really recommend doing that because that will give you a sense of what topical areas of life Jupiter's entrance into Gemini is likely to activate. And especially when it first enters, when a planet first enters a sign, moves into a new house, it will often sort of you'll notice it. The lights will start flashing because Jupiter is a weighty planet and it brings a lot of energy into the new house and hence the new topics. So you'll often notice late May, early June, you're really going to feel the rush of Jupiter moving into Gemini in a new house in your chart. So what I want to do today, though, is we're not going to talk so much about horoscopes, and I will probably do a second round of horoscopes before Jupiter enters Gemini. Certainly in June, we have a new moon in Gemini, Jupiter in Gemini trining Pluto in Aquarius. Those are big transits. So there's going to be a lot of, future horoscopic takes on Jupiter into Gemini that we'll have for you. But today, what we want to do is start considering the archetypal meaning of Jupiter in Gemini. And we have to do that in a couple of different ways. So five things to watch for, and I'm just breaking this down into sort of five different talking points. The number one most important thing that we can do to help ourselves understand Jupiter's meaning in the sign of Gemini is to first start with the way in which ancient astrologers tended to explain the meaning of one planet in another planet's temple. So Jupiter is not at home in Gemini. It's at home in Sagittarius and Pisces. That was traditionally its masculine Sagittarius domicile and Pisces its feminine domicile. So those places are the ones in which Jupiter is like at home in his own temple. Zeus originally, right? So when you take Jupiter and place it into the opposite sign, which will always be a Mercury-ruled sign. If you take Jupiter from its home sign of Sagittarius and place it to the opposite sign of Gemini, it's in a Mercury-ruled sign. If you take Jupiter in Pisces and place it into the opposite sign of Virgo, it is in a Mercury-ruled sign. Mercury's masculine and feminine domiciles are Gemini and Virgo. And so we take Jupiter and we place it into a Mercury-ruled sign, and we get the amplification of a very basic archetypal tension between two planets that was inherent in the language of ancient astrology. All archetypes in ancient astrology exist in a kind of community, and the archetypes are always in conversation with one another and have ways of harmonizing and also of existing in polarizations or like dualities and conflicts that can arise between them. And it's really important to understand what the basic meaning is of any archetypal combination, and then trying to think about how that might play out in different situations. So to break it down to its most basic level, Jupiter in Gemini will be understood only insofar as any of us have taken the time to think about Jupiter and Mercury and the tension inherent between the two planets. So let's talk about it very basically. Jupiter, broadly speaking, or Zeus, and remember, Mercury was Hermes, and this is in the ancient Greek Hellenistic astrological language before they came to receive their Roman names. Jupiter, Zeus, was broadly represented everything that grants coherence either to human life or to the cosmos itself. Zeus, as the ruler of the gods on Olympus, you know, this sense of cosmic order. And in the human world, our institutions are supposed to be ideally a reflection of the cosmic order of Zeus. So schools, the justice system, education, religion, all of these kinds of systems that are ideally meant to create order, harmony, balance, and cohesion in human life. Ideally, because we live in a world that's not ideal, right? But ideally, they are reflections of the greater cosmic order, which is musical. It's inherently like it's sensible and beautiful. So sensible meaning that there's something like the intelligence of a musical scale going on all around us, but it's beautiful in so far as the notes on the musical scale represent something whole and complete. And when the musical scale is playing itself out, there's beauty inherent in it. There's the cosmos from Zeus's perspective is both beautiful and coherent. Think, for example, of the fact that Jupiter in Pisces happens to also be the exaltation of Venus. So that any time you had the ancient world, you had the sense of harmonia, this greater sense of cosmic coherence. It was considered to be not only like rational and ordered in some kind of like logical sense, like a musical scale has like a kind of science behind it, but it's also beautiful. It's aesthetically pleasing. And ideally, human beings, wise sages, I mean, remember for Plato, it's philosopher kings. And in India, early place of astrology, you also have the idea that the wisest should be the most sort of spiritually advanced, the people leading the civilization in ancient India. Not again, this is ideally, not literally. Ideally should be sort of like Brahminical. There should be a sense in which you're a wise person. And all of the ways in which the ancient world does or does not live up to any of this is not really the point of what I'm talking about, because we could definitely go down that path, right? But what we are saying is that on an archetypal level, on a symbolic level, the idea is that the society that we live in, society, that it should ideally reflect this higher sense of beauty and truth and orderliness. Okay, so that's like Zeus. Hermes is very different. Okay, so if you think about Hermes, Hermes is someone who is constantly spending time in the sunny suburbs of the cosmos, Zeus's realm. But then Hermes disappears, dives down into the realm of Hades, who is Zeus's brother and counterpart, goes into that dark realm, which is really a realm of chaos and destruction, and then comes back out. So one of the most maddening things for Zeus and for any of us who like order and balance and beauty and sensibility, and you know, like we believe that the universe is sort of a beautiful whole and sacred place, right, is like, well, there's nothing more disturbing than like school shootings in the news. Do you know what I mean? There's nothing more disturbing than chaos and like evil or like just like darkness. And we don't know what to do with the fact that despite the ideal, there's, you know, this world sort of can't perfectly replicate that sort of Platonic sense of perfect beauty and order. It just can't. There's chaos. And there's been all sorts of ways philosophically, theologically, of reckoning with or sort of trying to reconcile ourselves to the sort of bloody and chaotic mess of life. But that's Hermes' domain in a sense. Not that Hermes is evil or dark or chaotic, purely speaking, but only that Hermes represents the understanding that the two sides, the yin and the yang, the dark and the light, the upper world and Hades' underworld, the sense of order and the inevitable reality of impermanence and chaos are two sides of the same coin. Hermes, in this sense, was properly called the progenitor of astrology itself. Because astrology, after all, as a huge kind of archetypal science, a symbolic science, is all about understanding opposites and understanding that they are always co-present. So when you have Mercury retrogrades, for example, what do they tend to do? They introduce chaos. and by chaos, I don't mean anything malicious, though sometimes we experience it that way, but they just bring in the Mercury retrogrades three times a year, bring in the natural breakdown of structures mentally or physically, or, you know, in our work or our relationships. They they go from something having been built up and formed and whole and coherent to something being called into question, to something being turned around, to momentum being stalled or delayed or set back, to reversals of circumstance or fortune. And if we're stuck in the realm of, you know, the suburbs of Jupiter, if we're stuck there, we will only ever see those reversals, setbacks, that kind of chaos magic of Hermes and Mercury. We'll only ever see it as something thwarting our will, or some kind of fly in the ointment, you know, some kind of, it's like a, there's a sense that, you know, how do we talk about, Mercury retrograde is messing with me. It's messing things up, you know, or we rail. I mean, people for thousands of years have railed against the, you know, it's like you human beings, you guys just can't get it right. I'm so frustrated because humans can't pull it together, you know, but it's like, no, of course we can't, because we're subject to the realm of Hermes as much as we are the realm of Zeus. And there is a very magical way in which chaos and destruction are part of life, right? In ancient India, you know, you've got the three gods of creation, of maintenance, and of destruction. And they are like a tripartite god, that they function as a whole. And so it's really easy for us in the West to think, I mean, we are captive to Zeus in our minds, even though most people, like, it's so funny how most people will be like, Zeus, you know, he's, I think most people would consider themselves not someone who primarily is like grabbed by Zeus. They'd be like, no, I like the magic of life. You know, I'm open to spontaneity. And like, yeah, you know, if the spontaneity is fun, you know, but, and like interesting, but as soon as chaos is introduced for creative purposes that we do not understand, that we cannot see, and we feel a lack of control, we feel deep, disturbing levels of doubt in ourselves, in our life path. When we feel humbled and some degree of our power has been taken away or stripped from us, you know, Zeus doesn't like those things being taken away. And insofar as we are, you know, held captive by the belief that life should only ever be perfectly coherent and rational and ordered and beautiful and sensible, and it all makes sense to me, and the reason this thing is happening, I can accept as long as I understand it, right? Well, that's us captive, you know, in our psyches to Zeus. We're not half as open to Mercury as I think most of us would like to think, in other words. And what's really important to remember is that this tension between Jupiter and Hermes is always there, and it's always asking us to consider that coherence includes chaos, and that chaos includes coherence, that there is a kind of rhyme or reason to the way that things come unglued, that they come unhinged, that we lose the plot, that the script is flipped, you know, that these things happen for reasons that we cannot understand in the moment. And therefore something like sacred doubt and faith are simultaneously required of us in almost all stages of life. It is so much better, you know, in a true like Mercury's Zeus kind of way, or Hermes Zeus kind of way. It's so much better to pray the prayer, this is what I'm hoping for, this is what I'm intending or I desire, and yet I have no clue to what end these things would bring me. And yet I have no clue if any of these things are actually in my best interest. And yet I have no clue if any of these things are actually what will bring me happiness or help me to become a wiser soul or whatever. That's the Zeus-Hermes dichotomy. It's like we try to order our lives in a way that, you know, we sort of premeditate, we get an idea of what the beautiful, coherent, set of life circumstances would be. And then, you know, we try to create that. And the universe seems to honor it. You know, it's like, yes, you can build things here. But don't be surprised as you go if there are lessons to be learned and they come in through chaos. They come in through the unpredictable, the erratic, the change, the reversal, the flip of circumstance, and also through real loss, through darkness, through doubt, through misery, through suffering. That's the entrance into the realm of Hades. We can't see when we're in there. You know, you can't, it's dark in Hades, in that underworld space. Or you can also equate that with the unconscious. So this tension between Jupiter and Hermes is fundamental. It is always a part of life. And honestly, most of us who probably think we're, you know, like I will say it for myself, I feel much more comfortable with Zeus than Hermes. And I think if anyone, for the most part, anyone who says otherwise is probably lying to themselves, because Hermes is much more challenging for us. I mean, sometimes, you know, like you will see people who have strong Mercuries in their charts, or, you know, mercurial dispositions, maybe a little bit, they have a little easier time sort of closing their eyes and, you know, putting the visor down like Luke Skywalker in Star Wars, you know, like I'll just trust in the Force. And but I do think that's what most of us are learning when it comes to this archetypal dichotomy. So now the other thing that's really important about the Jupiter-Mercury dichotomy is to understand that ancient astrologers said that when Jupiter was in one of Mercury's signs or Mercury in one of Jupiter's signs, the planet was said to be in its exile. Now, in my opinion, this is not, it's not a way of saying, oh, the planet is jacked up. Oh, it's a bad planet. It's not like that. It's telling you that this kind of language is telling us as astrologers that the tension, the archetypal tension between those two planets, which we've just described, is going to be heightened when you place one of the planets into the opposite sign. So when Hermes is in Zeus's signs or Zeus is in Hermes signs, you get the amplification of this archetypal dynamic. For example, it can be really hard for Jupiter to feel like things are coherent and building toward greater order and sensibility, and that you're building in the direction of your desires and seeing it grow, all Jupiterian things, when Jupiter's in a sign that tends to be more deconstructive, like Gemini. I'll talk more about that in a minute. But so starting off, if you want to start thinking about Jupiter for the next year in the sign of Gemini, you have to start thinking about the tension between order and chaos, or coherence and incoherence, or even like faith and doubt, or faith and questioning, or a sense of orderliness versus a sense of destabilization and chaos. You start working the tension of Mercury and Jupiter in your mind, and then you're going to be ready for not only the tensions, but also the interesting forms of synthesis. And we're going to visit those in just a minute. I just wanted to start here. Number two is that we need to understand the sign of Gemini. Every sign is most basically understood by understanding something of the planet who's who abides in that sign. So in this case, Hermes. But also, we have to ask the question, how did Hermes come to be assigned to this portion of the zodiac? In other words, why place Hermes or Mercury as the ruler or host of the Temple of Gemini in the first place? This has to do with the primary means by which the story of the zodiac and the organization of the zodiac was arranged in ancient astrology, which is by virtue of the sun's annual journey. So the most basic feature of the zodiacal organization has to do with what the sun is doing. Now, this is all symbolic. It's not literal. So what the sun is doing on a symbolic level from the standpoint of its journey through the zodiac, Aries through Pisces, in the zodiacal year. And the story is one of, surprise, surprise, the alternation between light and dark, opposites. We have Aries through Virgo as the light half of the year, where there's more light in the 24-hour period than there is darkness. And from Libra all the way through Pisces, we have the dark half of the year where there is more darkness than light in the 24-hour period. Again, this is Northern Hemisphere centric, but the story here is symbolic, again, not literal, because we're not dealing with a causal system. We're dealing with a divinatory system. So once we understand that, then we can start asking the question, what unique stage does Gemini represent in the sun's annual journey? And to explain this, I'm going to use a software program that I have. See if I can... Okay, hold on. I got to make sure that I've got it. And we're going to put this up over here. Sorry, I have an astronomy program I'm going to share with you guys, but I need to make sure that I get it up on the screen correctly. Here we go. All right. So this is a program that I like to use. It is called Starry Night Pro, in case you are interested in picking it up. It's a nice astronomy program that, you know, for just basic hobby purposes, I use to demonstrate things in my classes. So here we are. This is the beginning of Gemini season that you're seeing on the screen right now. And that is primarily defined, you could say, by virtue of the fact that the sun is in the last 30 days of its ascent toward the pole star or toward the summer solstice, which will be when this green arc, the ecliptic of the sun, reaches its highest point. And then from that point forward, the arc of the sun will start to descend. So this is the sun at high noon on about May 22nd, the start of Gemini season. And we're going to move this forward just one day at a time. And what I want you to notice is that at high noon every day, the sun is going up higher. But what I also want you to notice is the turn that the sun is starting to make with the green line as it reaches up toward the apex. So do you see how the green line is starting to sort of swivel? And we're going to get all the way up to the pole star. The pole star, by the way, we don't get up to it, but we start reaching for it. The pole star is all the way back there. You can kind of see North Celestial Pole way up here. So the sun gets closest to the pole star that it will get. And that was thought of the sun as, that was thought of symbolically as the sun reaching up toward the Platonic realm of the ideals, because the pole star was fixed and unmoving. And so for the ancient astrologers, or it is, and so relatively speaking. And so that means that it represented something like the realm of the Aedae, the Archai, the gods, the forms. This higher divine mind was signified really by anything that was relatively constant and stable as opposed to constantly fluctuating. So anyhow, the sun reaches this point around the summer solstice, and it reaches this highest kind of ideal moment. But the whole time that it's moving up there, you can see that it's also starting to turn. So I'm going backward now to about, so let's watch this again. Watch as it goes up, how it's starting to turn to come down. And this is why it's so important, because as soon as it gets up, it's already creating the momentum. You can see that it's turning to come down. And this is Gemini. This is the meaning of Gemini. From that moment forward in Cancer, now it starts to literally descend, right? This is Leo. Now it's coming down further. And the light half of the year is going to take place all the way until the fall equinox, where it crosses the celestial equator here. And it does so around September 20th, 21st. See how it's crossing? Now, the rest of the year from here, this is Libra, all the way through Pisces, it will be below the celestial equator, which will give us more darkness in the 24-hour period than light. So we are in Gemini. If we run back again, in Gemini, we are above the celestial equator, which means we're on the light half of the year from, again, symbolically speaking, from the Northern Hemisphere. But what's really important for understanding the seasonal moment of Gemini on an archetypal level is that the apex of the light is occurring. So on the light half of the year, starting with Aries, light is dominant and light is rising. So we're on the light half of the year, but light is also increasing. So it's like the yang of the yang time of year. When it gets to Gemini, what's happening is you're reaching the apex, but also this turn is starting to occur. And this is why Gemini, among all of the signs, because this happens with all of the signs around the double-bodied signs, when a transition from one part of the solar year to another is occurring, which happens in Gemini, Virgo, Sagittarius, and Pisces, those double-bodied signs, they were called double-bodied because they're of two natures at the same time. What are those two natures? Well, from the standpoint of Gemini starting around late May, the first nature is the rising of the light. The second nature is the turning into the decline of the light. Two natures simultaneously. And you can see it in the sky swiveling. Now, technically, the actual descent downward doesn't happen until zero Cancer, but it doesn't matter because for ancient astrologers, what they're looking at is Gemini as the moving toward the apex and the very visible turn of the light back down. So it's even though the turn doesn't start until zero Cancer, it's like the car coming around a racetrack. It is going bending around the curve. And that's what's happening in Gemini. And this is where we get some of the most important significations from. Okay, so we said we have to understand Gemini to really move forward with our understanding of Jupiter in Gemini. So what does this mean, symbolically speaking, that and why do we place Hermes here? We place Hermes here, and we also place Hermes in Virgo, where the other turn from light to dark happens. Instead, in Virgo, we're actually handing over to the dark half of the year. Now we're handing over to the dark, to the waning of the light within the waning of the light within the light half of the year. But either way, Gemini and Virgo hand over to darkness. What does darkness represent? It's yin. Just broadly speaking, it's yin. What is yin? Yin is movement and change, distribution, diversity. Yin is also impermanence and breakdown and chaos, but it is also distribution and relating of things, relating of opposites, mingling of things. It's not one, it's many. So whenever you see the light rising to its peak and then turning, that's Hermes. That's what Hermes does. Hermes, as the evening star rises to its peak, stations, retrogrades, and turns and disappears. And then the morning star rises, stations, retrogrades, disappears. So Hermes' nature as an astronomical symbol mirrors what's happening in the sun's journey during this time of year. The sun is rising, and then it's going to turn back to darkness. So Hermes is associated with that turn. But broadly speaking, that turn metaphysically represents the natural rhythm of the universe that moves from order to breakdown, that moves from stability to instability, that moves from creation and maintenance to destruction and chaos, and then rebirth over and over again. Gemini as a sign is given to Mercury because there is a parallel between the alternation of light and dark and the typical alternation of light and dark that Hermes is always doing. And this is why Mercury comes in again as the ruler of the sign of Virgo when we hand over to the dark half of the year. The main thing is to understand that Hermes, unlike Zeus, like Zeus is like the legal system, you know, Zeus is like the doctrines or dogmas of the church, clear, you know, they ring out like a bell, you know, or the traffic laws or something like that. It's very Zeus. But when you think about Hermes, what you're thinking about is that hidden wisdom that understands that the greater coherence is made through the tension of opposites, which is why Hermes is the ancient teacher of astrology itself, which is why Hermes as a philosopher is constantly in Hermeticism, like mirroring things that Taoists say, right? So Hermes is like Zeus insofar as Hermes also likes coherence, but Hermes is much more the trickster because Hermes realizes that coherence is paired with chaos, that faith is paired with doubt, that order is paired with destruction. Hermes knows that very well. So when we place Jupiter into Gemini, we are placing Jupiter, the grantor of that great sense of coherence, into a sign that is a lot more comfortable, generally speaking, with the marriage of opposites and their fluidity than Jupiter is, right? Like Hermes is much more comfortable with that dichotomy and the fluidity between things than Jupiter is. Sometimes it can go in the opposite direction, where Jupiter might be a little bit better at holding together with commitments, and Hermes can use the existence of opposites and spectrums and fluidity to evade or escape responsibility, which is why Hermes is also associated with thieves and liars and people who deceive, tricksters. And so it's an interesting place for Jupiter to inhabit for the next year. So I want to move from this kind of understanding of the Jupiter-Mercury dichotomy and understanding Gemini as a sign from the standpoint of the solar story of the year into three things, three themes that emerge from these tensions and from these symbols. All right, number three is sacred doubt and questioning. Anytime that Jupiter enters a Mercury-ruled sign, particularly an air sign, a masculine air sign, we are going to potentially go through a period of time where the most important thing that we can do for the sake of greater coherence, clarity, order, understanding, and so forth, wisdom, is to allow ourselves to question things, to allow our minds to introduce chaos or doubt, and to hold space for them as sacred and not apart from or opposed to the greater process of developing understanding in our lives. Like, we have to make room for questioning, doubt, skepticism, anxiety, existential doubts and worries. The deconstruction of our faith is the exact sign for most of us that it's growing. When we start to call things into question that we've held dear, at first it can feel destabilizing, but if we allow space for sacred doubt and questioning to take place, we often find ourselves the benefactors, a Jupiterian word, of greater understanding. Because we've created room or made space for more than we thought was possible. Or we have introduced that radical idea that several things, several powerful truths can coexist. So sacred doubt and questioning is a part and parcel of the process of building wisdom and understanding. Hermes and Zeus are always actually working together on the level of developing our wisdom, knowledge, understanding, whether we're learning a craft or a skill, or whether we're just progressing in some spiritual understanding. Number four, learning as deconstruction and reconstruction. It is not uncommon when Jupiter goes through a Mercury-ruled sign to feel like something that you thought you knew, a skill, an ability, an organizational philosophy that you've had, or a system that you've been using technologically or in the workplace, or a way of doing things as a parent, or a way of organizing and granting coherence in your relationship, just wherever Jupiter has created some sense of this is the way we do it, that there is going to be a process of learning new things or deconstructing things in order to reconstruct them. So deconstruction and reconstruction as a process over the next year in any area of life where you feel like there's been an established way of doing something. Now there's going to be a different way of doing something. And again, just like sacred doubt and questioning, we have to be comfortable with the fact that we might be in a process that is a little chaotic for a while, but it is not necessarily just contrary to or opposed to or an enemy of some greater sense of order that will come eventually. We have to be open in the next year, in other words, to deconstructing things, learning new things, and then reorganizing things, because lots of new ideas and information and thoughts and perceptions and people and connections are likely to come into our life. When they do so, they will it's almost like throwing things up in the air and being like, you know, it's like, I can't juggle all of them. I can't catch all of them. And some of them are going to fall on the ground and then we're going to pick everything up. And when we lay down all of the fragments on the table, we may find that they resemble or reflect an entirely new order. That process, we have to place our trust in it. Or at the very least, we have to be comfortable being like, I don't know where this is heading, and I'm not going to try to control everything too much. Now, another thing that can happen is that we can, in the chaos, we can lose commitment. For example, classic example, Jupiter enters Gemini in the seventh house and someone starts dating a million people. You know, they're just like, I'm just going to throw my hat in the ring and I'm going to date like five, start dating all these different people. Some people that works. They're going to start dating all these different people and they are going to, that person is going to start having some kind of philosophical crisis in their head about whether they should just remain open to having fun or if they should just close, you know, close things down with three or four of these people and start seeing only one or two of them, whatever. The point is that there is going to be a tension between allowing for, enjoying, and sort of welcoming the creativity and the chaos of Jupiter and Gemini. It's like a beehive, you know? And that there will be a temptation in that chaos to say, screw it, I don't have any commitments. Commitment, you know? Jupiter and Gemini, in other words, can become like ironically dogmatic about remaining open-minded. I'm going to remain open-minded at all costs. I'm not committing to anything that, you know, I'm open to possibilities, people say, you know, and that's fine. But you may find over the course of the next year that there is a tension between possibilities and openness and the need for decisiveness, decision-making, commitment, and a sort of stick-to-itiveness. And we want to hold the tension of the opposites rather than collapsing into an extreme. Oh, look at all this chaos. I'll just get really rigid and structured and dogmatic about my way. Or I need to open myself up. No commitments whatsoever. These extremes, in other words, watch for. Be careful of the extremes that come with sort of wild, unbridled possibilities. Jupiter and Gemini almost always brings the need for exploration, experimentation, and the magic, the chaos magic of Mercury as the teacher for the year. You know, that's our guru, right? But we do have to be careful, because the one thing that can happen with anything mercurial, especially in Gemini, an air sign, is that we can use that flexibility and that open-mindedness for selfish reasons, or to avoid or escape different kinds of moral or spiritual accountability, or like commitments. So kind of keep that in mind, but don't take it so seriously that you don't open yourself up. So again, it's just that tension of the opposites that we have to hold. And isn't that what this is all about? I mean, the teaching of Hermes at the end of the day, the progenitor and like wizard of astrology itself, Hermes. What is Hermes' lesson overall? It is that we don't understand anything unless we understand opposites. Ancient astrologers were on so many levels aware of the existence of opposites. Some rise in fortune or fate, some fall. Some who are great lose everything, some who have nothing gain everything. This world is a constant turning, burning, churning of opposites. And rather than do away with them through some kind of fascist doctrine of oneness, you know, which tips into the favor of Zeus, by the way, we have to be able to see the oneness, the togetherness, the unity in and through the fluctuation and tension of opposites themselves. We have to be able to hold space for difference and unity at the exact same time. That is the alchemy of life. And so this is a great chance for us to be reminded of that when things get flipped on their head and order and disorder and chaos and coherence are in this kind of playful, magical wrestling match for the next year. So anyway, that's what I've got for today. I hope that this was a useful meditation on Jupiter's entrance into Gemini. At the very least, that it starts the internal process of preparing ourselves for Jupiter's movement at the end of this month. After I sign off, you'll find a video where I talk about the upcoming class, Ancient Astrology for the Modern Mystic. If you like this, by the way, this is the kind of thing we do in our program. We talk at length about every single planet in relation to all the other planets, where the dignities categories come from, where the solar journey of the sun moves, how it moves and how it defines the zodiac, how rulerships were first assigned, the difference between houses and signs, which most people have no idea about. So many things that can deepen your astrology practice and really change your life. So if this kind of stuff feeds you when you hear it, you would really like this program. So check it out. And I sign off. You'll get to hear more about it. All right. Hope you guys have a great day. Take it easy. Bye. Hey everyone, thanks for sticking around. I'm going to tell you a little bit about our upcoming program, Ancient Astrology for the Modern Mystic, my year one course in ancient Hellenistic astrology that begins on June 16th. If you'd like to learn more about it, of course, you can always do some digging and looking at the course page on your own. I'll take you over there right now and walk you through it. But if you want to, you can go over yourself and look. Nightlightastrology.com is the website. Click on the courses tab and go to the first year course. This is the one that begins on June 16th, the perfect place to start for people who would like to learn more about natal astrology from the Hellenistic point of view. So this is a one-year course in Hellenistic astrology, which is the oldest form of astrology, and it is the form from which all subsequent forms of astrology come from. It shares a lot in its roots with ancient Indian astrology. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about what characterizes Hellenistic astrology, but just to familiarize you with this page, when you go to the first year course page and scroll down, you can learn more about everything that's included in the course. Some of the main features include 30 classes on the year. These classes are spread out through units of curriculum. And in between the major units of curriculum, we have breakout study sessions led by our tutoring staff. We also have an interactive group forum discussion that is staffed with tutors year-round. You always get your questions answered within 24 hours. So there's a lot of support built into the program as we work our way through the curriculum. We also have recommended reading, listening, optional quizzes, flashcards, bonus lectures, more than you could possibly read in a year, honestly. So we just have a large and long biography and sort of library of suggested bonus content that will fill in blanks and also supplement and deepen the material that we are studying. You get lifetime access to all the recordings. If you cannot attend the webinars live, they meet on the weekends. But if you can't attend them live, then you are welcome to follow along with the recordings, which are made available to you on the class website. So this class meets on Sundays from noon Central to 2 p.m. Central or 1 Eastern to 3 p.m. Eastern time. And you might translate that, I guess, if you're on the West Coast, it would be what, 10 a.m. to noon Pacific time. During the program, in addition to working our way through all of the major curriculum, the major foundational elements of Hellenistic astrology, we place a strong emphasis on preparing ourselves to read charts for other people. Whether this is a hobby for you or something that you are endeavoring to practice professionally, the course is built for people who are really there for a lot of different reasons. This is your hobby. This is your passion. You hope to do this for really no one other than yourself or maybe friends or family or someone who really decides they want to start a practice. You can take this class at whatever level of interest or depth that you want because of the amount of material that we make available to you inside and outside of class. You always have access to the program too, so you can always, you know, take it at your own pace. You can attend live, follow along with the recordings, some combination of both. And then the breakout study sessions are really helpful in addition to our interactive group forum discussion. You can always ask us questions. You can email me anytime with questions. So we have a lot of support in place. Now, the curriculum, we move through the foundational elements of ancient astrology. You may look at the curriculum and say, well, I know something about these things already, but not really, not unless you've studied Hellenistic astrology, because the way that ancient astrologers talked about houses, signs, planets, aspects, essential dignities, chart delineation is radically different from what most people learn when they start studying modern astrology. The reason for that is that it's only been in the past couple of decades that we have finally had access to the vast majority of ancient texts on Hellenistic astrology. We were literally missing the bulk of our ancient tradition. So the kind of rebirth or reawakening of ancient astrology is really new, which makes this very exciting because everything you've learned in modern astrology is probably coming from the lens of what is called psychological astrology, which is a way of looking at the birth chart in terms of the planets, signs, houses, and the way in which they may relate to your psychological makeup or profile. In this way, birth charts are a little bit like an elaborate Myers-Briggs. So you have the personality profiling, which is the way that most people look at planets, houses, and signs. You'll notice my Mars, my Venus, and they think of them as aspects or dimensions of your character and personality. And there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, we utilize much of the same language. And we certainly have that approach available to us in this program because ancient astrologers also looked at the chart in terms of psychological makeup. However, one of the main distinctions between modern astrology and ancient astrology is the emphasis that ancient astrologers placed on prediction. They looked at the chart in terms of a field of karma that defines the native or the individual's fate or destiny. And so we look at houses, signs, planets, aspects as a way of understanding what patterns, themes, and topics are going to be most prevalent and at what times, because they also had a very elaborate system of timing techniques. The year one program is all about learning to read the birth chart and understanding the ancient hermetic sort of Platonic Pythagorean philosophy that was behind the establishment of all of the doctrines and teachings of astrology itself. So it's really about understanding where everything comes from. It's the why behind everything that greatly empowers people when they're learning astrology. It is not nearly the same when you just study lists of adjectives and descriptions for houses, signs, planets, aspects. We want to understand why. Why do we do these things at all? Where did it all come from? And when you understand that, then you have something like a skeleton key by means of which you can access your own creativity, your own intuition, rather than being told, just play these notes in this order and it will sound good. You're learning to improvise, which, you know, could anyone ever want to play? Why would you want to play an instrument if someone told you, well, here's how to play. Play this, play this, play that. And you never learned how to play something of your own, or you never learned how to use the scales in ways that were magical and, pertain to your own genie, your own genius. So when we study ancient astrology, one of the main things we're doing is we're taking people beyond anything that they think they've learned about houses, signs, planets, aspects, and we're teaching them where it all came from. And once you have that, then you're really cooking with fire. You have a magical, intuitive capacity that is very rare and precious in astrology. So anyway, we move through a lot of different elements, but not in the way that you've ever learned them before. And that's a really important distinction. So anyway, after all of that has been said, in each unit, we spend, maybe up to 10 hours on houses. And then we have a breakout study session. And then we have reading and bonus material. So when we talk about houses in this class, you are learning where the concept of a house ever came from in the first place, what it is, how it works, and how it's different from a sign. You're also going to unlearn and break a lot of bad habits, because not by any intentional ignorance, but modern astrology, being bereft of its ancient textual tradition, has been teaching a lot of things that are just not in line with where the actual theoretical foundations of astrology come from. So you're also going to break some bad habits, which is really good for people who maybe know a little bit about astrology already, but are seeking to clarify and understand theory in the context of the 2,000-year history of astrology. So anyway, this class is going to prepare you to read birth charts for other people. But then by the end, one of the great things about the program is that the way we do that is not just by pumping you full of theory and history and philosophy. We are also, in the last portion of the program, inviting live clients into the class. And that's great, because when we have live clients come in, you're going to see me read from them using the theory and techniques that we've been studying. And you're going to see how they can be applied artfully, as well as giving you some tools and methods and techniques to use to set you up for success. Seeing live astrology practice while studying it is the best way to learn. So the last portion of the program, we turn toward that hands-on approach. Anyway, so that's a bit about the program. If you have any questions you want to ask, email us info@nightlightastrology.com. We're happy to answer any questions you have whatsoever. I also want to point people to the payment options at the bottom. Early bird payment saves you $500 off. That is a great way to save. The payment plan is breaking the tuition into 12 monthly installments. If that works better for you, no worries, you can do that. And then need-based tuition. We, for many, many years now, dating back to 2010 when I started teaching astrology, I've always had some kind of sliding scale option available for people when studying astrology. Sacred science like this should be accessible to people of all different socioeconomic backgrounds. So we pride ourselves on making sure that there is tuition assistance available, so that if your budget doesn't match with the payment price that we ask for, and that's an honest assessment that we trust you to make, that you can take advantage of the tuition assistance and set your price within a sliding scale that we provide for your monthly tuition for 12 months through the program. So please feel free to apply for that if it makes sense to you. We don't want people hurting themselves or overextending themselves. A price that fits your budget is available through the need-based tuition. We just ask that you apply early, because we do fill up sometimes. So anyway, that is it. I hope that you will consider studying with us, and thanks for taking time to learn more about the program. See you later.